Compliance is a profession where people work tirelessly to make the world a better place. And there are hundreds of amazing and inspiring women who have helped the field develop into what it is today. Great Women in Compliance is part of the Compliance Podcast Network, so join Mary Shirley and Lisa Fine as they talk with women in compliance who are making a difference.
Welcome to the Great Women in Compliance podcast on the Compliance Podcast Network and sponsored by Corporate Compliance Insights. This show is hosted by Lisa Fine and Mary Shirley. I'm Mary Shirley, and today I'm thrilled to have Kelly Paxton on the show. She is such an expert at certain areas of white collar crime, and I know this is going to be a really interesting show today. So welcome, Kelly. Please tell us about your working history and what led you to specializing in fraud.
So thank you so much for having me on. My working history was like nothing I could have planned. I got out of college. I became a stockbroker and a bond trader. And while I was a stockbroker, we had a client who was arrested for wire fraud. And I always knew he was like hinky. And one day a special agent from customs called, and this was before, you know your customer, KYC. And said, oh, we might be sending a subpoena down. So what happens is he gets wind of it and his money is gone. Well, fast forward a year later, I call her up and I say, I knew he was hinky. I want to do what you do. And, you know, 6 months after that, I'm in Georgia shooting guns, driving fast cars, and I became a special agent. So I have literally never touched a gun until I was 30 years old. And they hired me because of my background in finance. And I was just incredibly lucky, and I couldn't believe I got a paycheck to follow people, go through bank records, and all that sort of stuff. I did that for about 5.5 years, and then my husband got a job in the middle of the country with no border. So customs, no border, didn't work. So I stopped doing, you know, law enforcement for a couple of years. I did security clearances for the government, and then we moved back home to Oregon, and I started working at the sheriff's office. And I came and got my certified fraud examiner, and I became the fraud analyst for their fraud team. And one day I realized that all my suspects for embezzlement cases were women, with the exception of one man who I say stole like a woman. And it literally, meaning less and other reasons. But I started Googling the term woman embezzlers, and I find this term pink collar crime. And it kind of changed my life, because when I was a special agent for U.S. Customs, I arrested your typical bad guy, money launderer, drug dealer, pedophile, you know, wire fraud, scary people. And then I go to the sheriff's office and I'm arresting moms, like nice people that I would have, you know, their kids went to school with my kids. And it was a total change for me to see that good people make bad choices. And so I find the term pink collar crime that Dr. Kathleen Daly popularized in 1989. And I got the domain name, I think, in 2010. And I just have, you know, kind of created a niche, like, you know, no other niche, pinkcollarcrime.com. And yeah, that's kind of how I got to where I am.
That's awesome. And what I love about your story is that right at the beginning, you set your sights on something and you didn't sort of give yourself time to doubt or hesitate. Like, you weren't doing research about how to do customs and border patrol. You basically just said to a person, I want to do what you do. And you immediately outlaid what you wanted and then set about the course of going to get it. So I think that's an awesome story and really interesting work. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, that's nice. I mentor a lot of people getting into the fraud field, and I tell them, pick up the phone, send an email, send a LinkedIn connect. The best things that have happened to me have been from me reaching out and not being scared to do it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's been a theme that we've had on the show before, is when you want something, it seems so common sense, and yet not everyone does it, is to simply tell someone who can help you what it is that you want.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Awesome. And you mentioned good people make bad choices. And I think I've seen some work of yours before where you've mentioned that honest people steal as well. Will you tell us a little more about that?
So yeah, you know, you have the fraud triangle, which consists of opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. Mm-hmm. And you know, you need all three parts of it in order to commit fraud. And most people assume that it's opportunity is the easiest part to control. Mm-hmm. Pressure is not so easy to control. And rationalization, you can control a little bit, tone at the top. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't get out of bed in the morning if I thought that everyone was out to steal. Mm-hmm. But I think as the day progresses, sometimes for people, something happens and then they make a poor choice. Like, you know, their kid is sick or their spouse has left them or COVID-19. I mean, I'm working on a new presentation about COVID-19 and the fraud triangle. People mm-hmm. that have never experienced this before, going months without, you know, paychecks, getting mm-hmm. fired, getting laid off, mm-hmm. not being able to get unemployment, they're going to make choices that they didn't think they ever could make.
Mm. So, yeah, that's interesting. And you're an expert on pink collar crime, and you've just mentioned that. Will you please share a little more detail on what this is and what defines it as a distinct subset of white collar crime?
Absolutely. So Kathleen Daly, who is actually in Australia now and doesn't do this specific type of work anymore, wrote about it in Criminology magazine in 1989. And the definition is lower level employees, comma, primarily women, who steal from the workplace, petty amounts. So it's the offense, not the offender. And while most people assume I'm talking about women committing crime, it's more the position. But in the United States, 90% of bookkeeping positions are, you know, taken up with women. Mm-hmm. So I'm known as the fraud hashtag queen. And one of mine is it's position, not gender. But when, you know, and most people have an issue with my title, Pink Collar Crime, are women. And I always make it very clear. I want women to succeed more than anything. And the problem is women are in the lower level positions. So until men get pushed into the lower level positions, mm-hmm. you know, women are going to continue to commit pink collar crime, which is also known as I say, garden variety embezzlement, asset misappropriation as a trusted employee from a business. So women are just in those positions, and it's the one crime women really excel at.
Interesting. And we know that women tend to defraud or embezzle organizations of less money than men typically do. So in fact, the glass ceiling is everywhere. Do women typically have different rationale for committing fraud or embezzlement than men do?
Well, according to a recent Pew research, over 40% of women are now the primary breadwinners in, you know, the United States. So women now have the same pressures that men have had for generations. And what's interesting is in COVID-19, more women have lost their jobs than men, because more women are in service type positions. Mm-hmm. And those were the jobs that, you know, were first to go.
Exactly.
So, the ACFE, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, does a report to the nation every 2 years, and women are more likely to have a true pressing financial need than men when they start embezzling. So yeah, women are just, you know, they're in the primary breadwinner's position more now than they ever have been.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand you correctly, It tends to be the fact that women are less likely to steal just for pure greed and more likely to steal when they have circumstances where they need to meet some kind of financial obligation, and they've got to find a way to do it rather than just, I like money.
Yeah, but there is a little bit of a caveat, and this mm-hmm. is anecdotally, that they may initially steal for that financial need, but then they kind of find out that they kind of like the lifestyle. Mm. And so it may start out truly as a need. It even could start out as an accident. I have seen cases where it started out as an accident and they're like, mm-hmm. I wasn't supposed to get that check. Oh, oops, no one noticed that. And then mm-hmm. it happened. But they like the lifestyle. I mean, they like going to Olive Garden instead of McDonald's. And, you know, And then it really spirals out of control. It never gets less. They never stop. Mm-hmm. So it may start with the need, but then they get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I think it's easy to get accustomed to nice things.
Yeah.
Awesome. So we know that a red flag for corruption can be when officials have material possessions that do not seem to align with their expected salary. And similarly, the biggest indicator of fraud is someone living beyond their means. What are the other red flags that you tend to see in fraud cases that compliance officers should watch out for?
Sure. So one of the things, I like to call them pink flags when it's pink collar crime. But
makes sense.
One of the things, and you might be surprised, is no vacations.
Mm-hmm.
So if an employee isn't taking a vacation, and actually there's been several big cases, but one was Bernice Geiger, who stole $2.15 million from her dad's own bank in the 1950s. And when she was arrested, allegedly, I heard this on Freakonomics. I haven't been able to validate it, but I'm pretty sure they do good work. She was exhausted. Why was she exhausted? Because she couldn't take any vacations. So she goes to prison for 5 years. She gets out of prison. And allegedly, she went and she worked for the government agency, which we now know as the FDIC. She consulted for them and she looked at people who didn't take vacations. And I've had cases where I had a dentist who, 6.5 years, her office manager had never taken, she had taken 1.5 days. And the dentist was so sweet. She's like, well, she was dedicated. And I'm like, she's not dedicated. She's covering her tracks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the no vacations is, you know, I mean, that's banking makes you take 2 week vacations. And the younger generation likes to take microcations, which are like 2 or 3 days. It needs to be more than a week. Because if you're gone for 2 or 3 days, is anyone going to cover your work? Most likely not. But if you're gone for a week to 2 weeks, people need to cover your work. And that's when things are found out, that errant check, that vendor that's not in the system. So vacations is something to definitely look for.
Yeah. Belabor the point. So that is because when you give up your position for a period of time so that someone else needs to cover for you, it means that they're likely to uncover things that you've been trying to hide and that you've been successful in hiding because of the lack of oversight from anyone else being privy to the systems that you have in place or the transactions that you've been doing. Is that correct?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. And in your type of role, conducting investigations is obviously a critical part of your skill set. What is your approach and what is your top tip for compliance officers conducting investigations?
I'm going to say empathy. And, most of the people, again, we're going to X out the psychopaths, the narcissists, but most of the people, have tremendous guilt over what they've done. And you need to be empathetic and you need to allow them to confess. And you can see it. They're physically relieved when they are, allowed to confess. So you need to build that rapport. You don't need to pound on the desk. They're humans. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they're humans. And like I said, these aren't generally scary people. They're nice people who made a bad decision. And I had a boss and I finished an interview one time and, he heard us laughing during part of it. And when the guy laughed, my boss is like, why was he laughing? And I'm like, well, first off, he was innocent. And second off, like, he's going to be my source and there is no need for me to make him cry. And my boss was ex federal law enforcement. And he's like, I love to make him cry. And I'm like, it doesn't make anyone feel good to make someone cry.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be empathetic. They're humans, So.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. I certainly support that. And what are some of the increased fraud risks that COVID-19 has exposed companies to? And how should we adjust our approach to risk assessments in a post-peak COVID-19 world?
So again, back to the fraud triangle, you have opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. And, you know, a lot of times it's like, maybe you can control the opportunity, but there's no pressure. Like, you know, your employees are being paid well, and there's no rationalization. Well, in this COVID world, post-COVID world, you're looking at opportunities. People are working from home. So maybe, you know, a business has allowed employees that normally wouldn't get purchasing cards or credit cards. They're like, get this and buy what you need to set up work from home. And they forget that they gave access to, you know, credit cards. Or maybe one of your clients needs to pay you with a different bank account for some whatever reason. And you forgot that you opened that bank account. And 6 months down the road, the accounts payable person realizes, oh, we've got that extra open bank account. I can start, you know, funneling money through that. So definitely, as a business, you are going to want to keep track of any sort of lack of control that you've instituted so your employees can work from home. And I saw a great article about that, was that, you know, everyone's been just in the last 2 months, just get it done. Mm. But the just get it done there's going to be holes in the system. Mm-hmm. And then you also, as part of the fraud triangle, you have pressures. And some people have pressures now that they never had, they never foresaw. I mean, you think of some medical offices. I have a neighbor who's a doctor. And he's like, he's not been able to book his time like he's been able to. Mm. You would never think of a doctor in his specialty being financially strapped. Mm. But, you know, they're not booking as much. They're not able to do procedures as much. Mm-hmm. And they still have quite a bit of overhead. So there are industries that people would never have thought that they would have been laid off or furloughed. And it has happened. So those pressures, the financial pressures are, you know, we're going to see a tsunami of them.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. And Kelly, before we started recording this episode, we were chatting and you mentioned having some prison pen pals as part of your research. Will you share with us some of the observations and insights of that type of experience?
Sure. So I've written to women in prison that have been sentenced for embezzlement. Mm-hmm. And just sort of 10 questions, you know, how did it happen? Has it ever happened before? It's kind of along the line of Eugene Soltis's book, Why They Do It. And one of the things of the women that did respond to it is that they didn't ever say that, you know, two wrongs make a right, but there was always a little bit of a tone at the top issue. Mm-hmm. You could tell there was a tone at the top issue. And actually, I have a colleague who is a data sleuth scientist, and she downloaded, you know, a company's all their bank records. And as she was going around with the boss saying, okay, this department is in charge of this, and she gets to his administrative assistant. And this is what the boss says to my friend: don't pay any attention to her. She's too stupid to steal from me. Guess who stole from him? Yeah. So that sort of tone at the top, I do see that in my sort of prison pen pals and that goes to rationalization. Mm-hmm. Absolutely goes to rationalization. If you're treating your employees like that, they're not going to feel so bad that first time they steal from you.
Mm.
So there has been, you know, some of that. I had one woman who, she stole over $8 million. And I asked her specifically about tone at the top. And she said that, again, two wrongs don't make a right. But she said there were definitely issues. It was a large family business. And, you know, the thing is these employees that are kind of in the weeds, they see everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They know where all the payments are going. They know when you get a business owner who goes to, say, a conference and takes their family and comes back with the Black American Express and says, fill out my expense report. And the administrative assistant sees that they're writing off, you know, all sorts of expenses for the family that went on that trip.
Mm-hmm.
what happens when that administrative assistant gets a text from their kid saying, hey, mom, you know, I need the last $50 or $200 for my school field trip. Mm-hmm. Their mind goes to, you know what? My boss just wrote off a $20,000 family vacation against the business, not mm-hmm. paying taxes on it. What's 50 or 200 bucks? And it might start with 50 or 200, and next thing you know, it's a lot.
Mm. Yeah. And something that you mentioned there reminds me of another, this is, I think, anecdotal as well, observation that I see, which is people have somehow convinced themselves that the company owes them in a certain way, that they're entitled to it. And so when you're talking about how you're treated in terms of that tone from the top, when people feel resentful, not that it's a valid excuse or a justification, but I think it's more likely to help people who are already on a slippery slope to feel convinced that taking what is not rightfully theirs, in their mind, it is rightfully theirs and that they have somehow earned it. And I do wonder in this COVID world where a lot of people who haven't necessarily lost their jobs but have received cuts to their salaries, whether it will have a similar effect on those individuals who are affected in such a way.
Absolutely. I mean, the COVID, post-COVID world, I think we're just going to see so much fraud and different types of fraud, not only embezzlement, but you're going to see, you know, the loan fraud for the PPP. Mm-hmm. And I know of a case where a spouse was working for a business and they were filling out the, you know, documentation for the PPP, and the numbers were getting a little bit exaggerated. Mm-hmm. And they went to their spouse who had personal experience with this, and they talked to the CEO and said, you know, you're going down a really slippery slope. And the CEO was kind of like, well, you know, I mean, the numbers would be true had COVID not happened. Mm. And it's, you know, and you see huge corporations like AutoNation that got a $77 million loan. Granted, they turned it back, but, you know, a statistic for an arrest, whether you arrest some small little embezzler or some white collar criminal, it's still one arrest. Mm. And it's a lot easier to arrest some small time crook than, you know, the CEO of a major corporation.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And people will think that, well, they would rather go after the CEO of a major corporation, like the Department of Justice or, you know, the FBI. And it's like, those people are lawyered up and it will last years. Why don't we go after someone who, you know, can't lawyer up and we can get the quick statistic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people don't understand that that's how justice sometimes, unfortunately, works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. And so, Kelly, I wanted to take an opportunity to wrap up the episode with you telling us your most interesting pink collar crime story.
So I had a young woman who, it was when I worked at the sheriff's office, and she was the only one out of all my victims where the victim said, I never liked her. Because usually these people that are in these trusted positions mm-hmm. are very well liked.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he never liked her. And when, you know, he found out he was embezzled, he actually thought she had stolen $400 on his visa.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was so angry with her because she kind of left him in a lurch. Mm-hmm. And so he called the sheriff's office and he's like, I want to report a theft. She charged two things on my credit card. Well, all of a sudden, he realizes something's not right. And it turns out she had stolen $450,000.
Mm.
And he's like, I never liked her. So I never gave her access to, you know, my bank accounts. And I'm like, well, you did, because she stole $450,000. And he was shocked. He had no idea how it happened. And this was back when you could do a refund to a credit card that wasn't, you know, the payment wasn't made on. So, you know, there have been controls now that this can't happen. But she was refunding all day long to her various credit cards.
Mm.
And he never looked at it because he owned a wine tasting room in a vineyard. And he said, people come in and they try the wine. And if they don't like it, they, you know, don't buy it. So there should be no refunds. And I'm like, but that's how she stole $450,000. I said, did you ever look? And he's like, well, no, because I just assumed there would be no refunds. And so she had quit the job and moved over, you know, a couple hours away and started stealing at the next place. And, you know, he just, he was so shocked because he thought he had put in the control. And that's where I get a lot of businesses, like I sign all my own checks, that people can still steal from you. Your employees can still steal from you. They can set up a false vendor. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of ways, but so many business owners are convinced that as long as they sign their own checks, they can't be stolen from. And her name was Tiffany. This is all public record. You know, she showed the business owner that you didn't need to have, you know, the checkbook to actually steal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a fascinating case.
Yeah. And this leads me to another question. You may not have an answer for me, but in case you do, you just mentioned that typically the people who are stealing are considered to be very nice and well-liked. Do you ever hear people saying, I can't believe it was her. She's the last person I would have expected, that kind of thing?
Oh my gosh. So every night I go to bed with a Google alert on embezzlement. Mm-hmm. And so it shows me new stories with embezzlement. And I can't tell you how many times the business owners have been, I can't believe it was her. I would have never thought it was him. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of like, it's not really a joke, but I kind of say that I'm a fraud therapist because people don't think it's going to happen to them. And when it happens to them, I always tell them, you can replace the money. You can sell more widgets. You can, you know, bill more time. But the problem is that the breach of trust is just devastating to them. It's devastating personally. It's also devastating. They're like, how did I not see it? So then they start to question so many other things. So I'm helping a business that $500,000 had been stolen recently, and they found me. And it's taken about a year for her to recover just, you know, mentally from it. And she saw one of my blog posts, it's, you need a therapist. And I actually got this from a victim. And because I put together a slide that said, these are your fraud team members and, you know, a lawyer, a CFE, computer forensics, and this nice woman who had been embezzled to the tune of $1 million. She goes, can you add therapist? And I kind of looked at her and she said, this was the most difficult thing in 30 plus years of marriage she and her husband had been through. The most difficult thing, because there was finger pointing. And he's like, how did you not see it? And she's like, how did you not see it? So that breach of trust, they will, people meet me and find out what I do. And they're like, so I have a friend. And they're telling, they want to tell me their story. It's like this secret society, and they literally never forget it.
And Kelly, you mentioned the embarrassment there. And I think people are almost shocked with themselves retrospectively that they've allowed, if you will, themselves to be put in the situation where they've been taken advantage of. And we've discussed previously that perhaps this can have an impact on reporting. I hear that fraud is very underreported, and I think you've got a good statistic on that. Will you share it with us?
Sure. So, you know, statistics can say anything, but this is a statistic that I hear pretty regularly. Only 15% of all embezzlement cases are turned over to law enforcement for prosecution, which is just, you know, so basically, are you the, you know, 2 out of 5 people that actually go to law enforcement? And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, shame and humiliation, but also, you know, you have to turn your books over to law enforcement. And there's a lot of businesses that aren't quite comfortable with that. I've also had, off the top of my head, one victim who, when she confronted the suspect said, I'm going to turn you into law enforcement because I know you write your expenses off against the business. And luckily the business owner is like, fine, call the IRS. I don't care. She called her bluff. But some business owners are just kind of like, well, you know what, let's call it good and don't ever call me again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not going to give you a good reference or anything like that, but we're just going to call it good.
Disappointing, but understandable how that can come about.
Yeah, I had a case recently where a nonprofit was actually ripped off. They realized it after they had heard my presentation. And and their attorney said, because it was a nonprofit, we don't think you should prosecute because your donors are not going to be happy. And I was just, you know, it happens. I always want my victims to prosecute. I do mm-hmm. understand why they don't, but it's always, there's a little bit of sadness in me when they don't prosecute because you know, once you get away with it, even when I say honest people steal, once they get away with it and they don't get caught, it's just so much easier the next time to do it. And then they mm-hmm. become serial embezzlers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Kelly, this has been super fascinating. I'm so glad that you agreed to come on the show and speak with us and really appreciate your expertise because a lot of us in compliance, we just kind of dabble in this area when it comes up and aren't super entrenched in it. So this was really interesting to me and thank you so much for your time and expertise.
Well, thank you. And I've always enjoyed working with compliance when I've had the opportunity to, because you guys like fix the system. I'm kind of like just holding one person to task, whereas you guys want to fix the system. And I like that type of work. It's better to stop it before it starts. And I think mm-hmm. compliance really does a great job at that.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words. I know our listeners will get a little boost in hearing that too.
Well, great. Thank you again.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Great Women in Compliance. We hope you'll join us in honoring the great women in the compliance field by subscribing to this podcast and leaving a review.